Good afternoon. It's just gone 1 o'clock on a Tuesday. That means it's time for the Daily Maverick Show on Cliff Central. I'm your host, Stilly Sharalambos. I'm joined in studio by the beautiful Ranjini Munasami. Welcome back, Ranjini. It's been a while since we've had you in the studio with us.
Yes, I've been having withdrawal symptoms.
Oh, well, okay. Well, the good kind of withdrawal symptoms, yes. I hope. Yeah. And we've got our FT editor, First Thing newsletter editor, John Supart. Welcome back, John.
Thank you. Still getting my daily dose here as well.
Cool. So the First Thing newsletter, you can get on Daily Maverick by subscribing to Daily Maverick or in the form of the Daily Dose with Cliff Central that goes out every morning. John is the editor and wakes up very early every day to make sure that all 70,000 recipients get informed and educated first thing in the morning. John, what are some of the highlights that you've been covering for First Thing in the last couple of days?
Yeah, I mean, well, the problem is you tend to get the news dominated by Islamic State and Ebola. So finding sort of the interesting news behind that in the past week is quite a challenge. Not to say ISIS and Ebola aren't important, and I tend to run them every day because there's always something going on. But today, for example, the Supreme Court ruling that I included in today's First Thing by the American court. Well, it wasn't a ruling so much as they refused to receive an appeal against gay marriage in the United States. And I think this was quite significant, given that it was the Supreme Court and thus on a national level rather than a federal level, which means there aren't just, you know, spots of states trying to pass or, you know, ban gay marriage again. So that was certainly quite significant. Obviously, the first Spaniard infected with Ebola outside of West Africa, which in itself is different to the American case in that it was a literal infection outside of the continent.
Yeah, I wanted to touch on the gay marriage piece that you covered, and that now it's 50 out of the 51 states in America, it's now legal for gay marriage to take place, which I think for the first time, there are now more states in America where gay marriage is legal than before, where it was legal in more states to marry your second cousin than it was to marry your gay partner. Now that it's now shifted and now gone to 30 out of 51, it's now, for the first time ever, gay marriage is now legal in more states than it is allowed to marry your second cousin.
I'm only slightly relieved for civilization.
Yeah.
to see that that's actually a marginal gain for gay marriage over sort of incestuous marriages.
And maybe we'll get to a stage where we can just call it marriage and not just gay marriage. Yeah. It always reminds me of this great cartoon that was in the New Yorker, depicts this elderly couple and they're watching TV or one of them's reading a newspaper and the topic of gay marriage comes up and the wife turns to the husband and says, you know, Ralph, what do you think of this gay marriage? Should we let it, you know, go ahead? And Ralph, you know, turns to her and says, I don't know, Doris. It seems they've suffered enough.
Yeah, I think I was searching for quotes this morning because with the First Thing newsletter, we always include a quote at the start. And I thought I was looking for something on gay marriage. And one of the quotes I encountered was, we should absolutely let the gays marry. They're the only ones who want to these days. that was my second choice, unfortunately. I didn't run with it today.
Yeah, and then the scary sort of news that the first case of Ebola being the infection actually being transferred or happening outside of the borders. I mean, that's it seems that the doomsday or the, you know, the prophecies and the and all the, you know, bad predictions are starting to come true. And does it scare the shit out of you, Ranjini?
Of course it does. But you know, there's also like a slant in the way Ebola is being reported, because there's like 2,000 people infected in Africa, and then one guy in Texas has it, and suddenly, you know, it's a global crisis, and now it's gone off to Spain, the news is completely on this nurse now, and I think 22 people she may have infected or came into contact with, and suddenly, you know, the entire reportage on Ebola is on that, and you know, not as you know, how it's being dealt with here in Africa. So yeah, but I suppose it's a new angle to it. And I believe that it was predicted that within 3 weeks it's going to reach the UK. So I don't know. I'm not sure how exactly that's going to happen. But, you know, it's sometimes the news channels also, you know, like with the reportage of the disappearance of the Malaysian aircraft, you know, you go into this like wild speculation territory of how exactly it's going to, you know, what's going to happen.
And everyone becomes an expert, and everyone's got a prediction, everyone's got an idea.
You know, you can just thumb suck, you know, that, you know, you can meet somebody in a bar and, you know, suddenly, in the airport bar, and suddenly Ebola goes with you where you're going, and then everybody on the plane gets it, and then everybody where you arrive.
It reminds me a lot of this sort of hyperventilation in the early days of the HIV crisis that the world faced, where there was a lot of misinformation flying around. I think we've seen exactly the same thing with Ebola, where, okay, one person with Ebola traveled to America and now one person is infected in Spain. But these are first world countries. They have first world health facilities. Those people who were surrounded or in contact with that Spaniard is now, they're all under observation. They're all receiving top class healthcare. I read a story the other day about Sierra Leone. There's entire containers full of medical supplies just sitting at the docks because of sheer mismanagement at the ports. You know, and I think that just serves to give a bit of the contrast where you have the country where three people are infected every hour versus one person ever. And the headlines all follow with the Spaniard.
But it's also hilarious the kind of hysteria around it, because I don't know if you saw the pictures of the CNN news strap where it said, should flights be banned from Africa?
The country.
Yes.
Yeah, Africa, you know, the country.
Yeah.
All of it.
Yeah. So yeah, there is a level of ignorance about it, but also, you know, I think there is growing panic of how it will continue to be spread, and for as long as there is no kind of containment of the epidemic, and I suppose as well speculation will continue.
And I guess in the digital age as well, it just makes for the easiest spread of misinformation as well as conspiracy theories. I mean, we've seen it in the past where a tweet from a hacked account, for example, can actually cause stock market crashes, you know, on the back of this misinformation. Now, anyone with access to a WordPress account can create a conspiracy website, and doesn't take much or long for some of that stuff to be, you know, propelled into the gossip mill, which then spits out, you know, a rumor that just, you know, can be tweeted, retweeted, and Facebooked ad nauseum, and just create this, you know, crazy panic.
The thing is that the phenomenon of social media, there is just absolutely no control, and especially with something like Ebola, you can cause your international panic, you know, with information just going out. Yesterday, Greg Nicholson and I were at the announcement of the new Reserve Bank governor. And we were just saying that, you know, we can start tweeting something reckless there and say, oh, he's, you know, he doesn't look
in good health.
Yeah, or you know, too clued up, and it can cause the rand to crash. You know, just the two of us, and that's how delicate.
Maybe from your account, Ranjini, but from my account, I don't think anyone takes anything seriously.
Well, to give you a perfect example of this, I mean, in the military sort of circles that I run around in, there was a claim by Terry Crawford Brown, who's now obviously in the Sariti Commission, talking about how the South African Air Force are flying zero A109. These are military helicopters at Astaplot Air Force Base. Now, he's absolutely correct in that, but he's correct because there are absolutely no A109s based at Air Force Base Astaplot. But of course, that point is not actually mentioned. So it just goes to show how a little bit of misinformation can create quite a lot of lack of confidence or you know, criticism, or just, you know, the stocks to crash.
I'm glad you mentioned military aircraft there, John, because we now get the chance to talk about the F-22. And
awesome.
Jenny, just be careful if John gets excited there across from you, across the table.
I'll try to keep it down here. Yeah.
Okay, so for those who don't know, the F-22, what is it, John? Where's it been used? What is it? It's not a Srinivani sex toy.
Absolutely not, and you certainly won't see it flying from Air Force Base Astaplot anytime soon. The F-22 Raptor is a stealth jet that's been in development by the U.S. military for decades now. Quite an advanced piece of kit, hellishly expensive, and in fact they stopped manufacturing them because they were so expensive during the financial crisis, and opted to go for the F-35 instead. That said, they now have an entire, I stand on correction here, but I think at least one squadron of F-22 strike jets in operation, and the first time they were used in combat was against Islamic State terrorists back, I think it was last week actually, when airstrikes entered Syria and became a fully fledged air campaign there.
What's the what's the exciting thing about these F-22s? What was that game where the wingspan or the
those Jane's trading cards that we used to play with as kids, throw them against the wall, maybe betraying my age here a bit, and whichever ones fall the closest, you get to win that battleship or whatever. The cool thing about it, I think, is obviously its ability to remain invisible to radar. Now, not just one kind of radar, but several different types. Now, I'm not going to put on my anorak and start talking about these things because, A, I'm not an anorak, so I don't actually know too much about it, but I do know that the aircraft does have remarkable stealth capabilities in that they're simply unable to be detected, which is what I suspect. And the US Air Force hasn't actually said anything about why they're used in Syria, but I suspect one of the reasons why they used them for specific missions was that Syrian air radar would be unable to pick them up and thus even interfere with American airstrikes. Certainly closer to the capital, I think that might be a concern, at least in Damascus. Mm.
And I believe the ability to bomb from like 15 miles away is also another big plus. It can drop bigger bombs from further away, essentially.
Yeah. I mean, if we're fighting the Russians, that would probably make a difference. Here, it's terrorists with AK-47s, you can bomb them from right above and it would be okay. Mm. Which is what I suspect the real reason the F-22 was used was, simply to test it, to give it some sort of combat characteristics and things like that.
Although, as we discussed last week, though, the Islamic State isn't just a bunch of guys with AK-47s anymore, right? They've taken over some military equipment from, you know, there are many victories in the region, and that's part of the problem, is that you're not fighting, you know, guys with turbans in hiding in caves, right? These guys are getting bigger and more sophisticated.
That's certainly quite true. And what they would have looted from the Iraqi arsenals, at least, would include what are called man pads, which is just basically Stinger missiles and shoulder launched anti aircraft missiles and things like that, which are dangerous to various kinds of aircraft that the US Air Force use, like the A-10 Thunderbolt, for example, which would explain why a lot of these airstrikes you're seeing launches from aircraft carriers, high altitude bombings and things like that, rather than close in air support, which is more characterized in Afghanistan, for example, where there aren't these anti-aircraft systems. So I think the airstrikes, certainly in Syria and Iraq, have been taken with a lot more care about what they're facing up against. I do dispute Simon's claim about, you know, fighter jets or things like that. Okay, certainly maybe captured, but whether they're operational, I highly, highly doubt.
Turkey, you mentioned today, seem to be sitting on the sidelines waiting and watching things play out. What's going on with Turkey's involvement in coming to the party as part of the Allied forces?
I wanted to actually start that story with the line of saying something like Cobain burns while Turkey fiddles, because it is literally a case where if you see anything in the news about IS at the moment, you will see this border town right from the Turkish side, and you'll also see a long line of Turkish M60 variant main battle tanks lined up there. Ready for what? I don't know, because it seems like they're not actually getting involved. One of the interesting arguments I actually read about today as well was saying, well, the Kurds are all about gaining independence for their own territory. This is theoretically, at least, a test of their independence. They should be able to defend themselves against an external aggressor. That's, of course, ignoring the fact that they don't have a really functional military or anything like that. And beyond that, there's the broader humanitarian problem here, where the Turkish forces are literally watching by while IS rips apart this town. Mm-hmm. And it looks like IS has now captured, I believe, the eastern part of the town, and are probably going to capture the rest unless something dramatic happens. Mm-hmm. Airstrikes are happening, but they're not actually having that effect in supporting the Kurds that I think they would like.
It seems like the approach is to wait and say, well, okay, this is our border. The minute you're over here, then we'll do something. The problem is that they might just be a hell of a lot more stronger and bigger and more effective by the time they actually do cross that border if they don't, take any action now. So it's kind of this really crazy situation. I guess, Ranjini, if we offered you a Daily Maverick trip to Syria or the Middle East right now, you'd probably decline.
You know what? I got sent to Iraq a week before the war. I thought the bombs
Which one? The first? Second one?
Second one. I'm not that old.
Okay, I'm just saying.
Desert Storm. No, it wasn't Desert Storm.
Well, Desert Storm was the first one.
Iraqi Freedom.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I went there a week before the American bombing started, and it was terrifying. So, but I find what's happening now, makes all of that look like child's play. But I think the other fascinating thing is that how Islamic State is able to recruit, especially in the US, and other places. I think that's quite terrifying. And I think that's, in the face of this onslaught and the way their reach is moving. And, for some reason, this is like, is some kind of appeal to people, who live in sort of modern democracies, but still find some kind of appeal to leave their families behind, leave their countries and go there and, join that cause. And, they actually have recruitment videos, which is also quite bizarre. But, I was also watching a thing of the women in Islamic State and how they operate. Because, I mean, you've got this very sophisticated military action on one hand, but then you've got this ground operation, people working in communities. And you find these women in hijab, fully covered up, and they walk around with heavy weaponry and looking for other women where they feel are not covered up or, they doubt their loyalties and, the woman was relating the story, was saying, she couldn't live with her conscience anymore in terms of what they had to do, to punish those people.
It's almost like this mob mentality you see in Rwanda, see in Kosovo, you saw in Bosnia, you see it here in the Middle East as well. That's, I guess, people are people all over the world.
And the fact that it's all being done in the name of religion, for being punishing women for not being covered up is somehow being related to, that they are not religious enough, they are not holy enough, and therefore they need to be punished in the most cruel means.
Yeah, I think one of the scariest things about the whole progression and development of IS, I think, was summed up when this American commentator was reporting or commentating on an Al-Qaeda released video. And after having watched the video, he said, this is boring. Where's the beheadings? Where's the like music and the editing that ISIS have now taken terrorism like to a whole new level? And I think when we saw pointing out that Al-Qaeda are like the light version of this, I think everyone really has a good reason to start looking for their brown pants.
And certainly the media campaign ISIS has been remarkably well polished, and I think that speaks of the I would say quality in inverted commas here of the jihadists joining them from European countries. These guys have computer skills, they have basic media and media and production skills, and are able to put together on an objective level a rather polished propaganda video, which I think is why when you look at these beheading videos as well, they don't show the actual beheading. Because nobody wants to see that unless people are particularly, psychopathic, towards that area. But everything leading up to it and afterwards is still quite violent, very disturbing, and gets their message across, which is, it's almost the entire point of a terrorist organization is to, promote that propaganda of the deed, whatever the deed is.
And a good point that you make is the way that they've used the media, right? So the way that they use social media to get it out there, the way that they also pick the right targets in beheading journalists and aid workers. Now, the two sort of camps or professions that are going to get a lot of media coverage, you know, even more. I mean, you know, as journalists, we rally around our own. When, you know, when one's attack, it's attack on all of us. And that's just going to get, you know, the entire world's attention, entire world's media attention.
As well as a guy performing the deed, that jihadi John. Yeah. I mean, there's a, it sounds like a bit
Not this John, I should say.
Yeah, but, you know, there's now like this phenomenon around him. And who is he? How did he, you know, where does he come from? You know, the British government has got this massive operation to try and track him down. But I think that all lends to this this mystery and, you know, fascination with Islamic State.
Okay, so moving on to something hopefully a little bit more uplifting than ICE, and unfortunately a phrase we have to use almost week in and week out when we're talking about world affairs and current affairs. Our sort of factoid of the week, we try and include something a little bit lighter and some facts. My fact of the week is that the UK has now for the first time included an estimate in its national books of national accounts, so what the effect on GDP would be if they included the domestic product of illegal drugs, the sale of illegal drugs and prostitution. And that number was estimated to be £12 billion. So there's sort of three facts rolled up into one. That's the first one. It's £12 billion would be added to the UK GDP. And the reason they're kind of doing it, it seems like that they're leaning towards, well, if we can quantify this now and put a number to it, we can maybe look at potentially legalizing it down the line, because a lot of European countries are now starting to already have included that estimate into their report on GDP and national accounts. So it seems like, you know, when you're running out of tax revenue without increasing tax revenue, where can we go? And it does seem like there could be a shift in thinking coming up. But the other facts that were interesting to come out of that was that at that number, there would be more than the GDP that is contributed by the combined sale of nicotine and alcohol in the UK, which puts it into perspective, because the UK can consume alcohol. If you've ever spent any time there, you'll know that they're up there in terms of the.
I'm still in detox from my year there.
Exactly. And then lastly, the third sort of fact rolled into this, from a very interesting article on The Guardian, if you get the chance to go and read it, was that they were made some assumptions around their estimations. And the 12 billion number has been criticized because there's so many assumptions and variables here that, you know, it's effectively guesswork. But one of the things they excluded from the calculation was the effect that male prostitution would have on that 12 billion number. So it really only pertains to female prostitutes that were included in that 12 billion number. Now you think, well,
exploit us, you know, doing it.
How big can the effect of male prostitution be on that number, you ask? Oh, yeah, well, I'm glad you asked that question. It's estimated that 42% of all sex workers in the UK are male. Which was a number I thought was
42%.
So Shrindavani has probably had a lot to do with that, stimulating that part of the economy. But it's a crazy number. It's a huge number, 42%, which I thought was quite interesting. So
hey, maybe we should look at that. You know, the ANC is desperate for radical economic transformation. Maybe we just need to rejig the way we look at the figures, you know. And the president wanted to create 500,000 jobs. Yeah, we can do it. Look.
Well, you know, I've always been a supporter of the move to legalize things like prostitution and drug and especially recreational drug taking, because it's going to happen anyway. So why don't we get the economic value of that back into the economy? Let's regulate.
Tax it and regulate.
Let's tax it and regulate it. Let's enforce health inspections on sex workers, for example. Let's, you know, get them a union so they're not trafficked people, for example, that they're tested regularly, that they, you know, that they're paying tax, that, you know, they're working in a safe environment and it's not run by, you know, the underworld, you know, the mafia, the gangsters, for example. And the same with drugs is, you know, we know that addicts will be a problem, but let's take them out of the hands of the gangsters. You know, if we look at
decriminalize it and you treat it almost as a health issue rather than a pathological social issue, which it isn't. It's it's a health issue first and foremost. Yeah.
And that's what addiction is. And what we're doing now by criminalizing it is pushing them into the hands of the gangsters. So an example I like to use often is, you know, when last did you see someone, you know, break into a house to steal a TV to buy a six pack of Amstel?
Yeah.
You know, It's because, you know, that they need to get their hands on illegal substances, which can only be acquired through illegal means. And generally, because of the big profit margins, that means it's, you know, the gangsters who are benefiting.
Absolutely.
So there's a, I mean, there's a whole massive debate around this. And which side of the fence do you sit on, Ranjini? I mean,
no, obviously with health work, I mean with sex workers, sorry, you know, there's a definite argument to be made, but I'm not sure about the drug trade, because where do you draw the line? You know, I mean, already we've got you know, a problem with schools, and you know, people always find ways to cross the line. So as it is, you know, and if there's kind of a relaxing of the trade, with a view to decriminalizing it, I just think that, you know, our country battles to regulate the most basic things, you know, and I just worry that, you know, if we do too much too quick, I think that we could make quick progress on the decriminalization of sex work, but I worry about the drug side.
I guess my sort of counter to that would be that it's not just an isolated decriminalization. Here you go. And basically,
have,
you know,
fun.
Go
knock
get fucked up,
out.
Go get fucked up every day of the week. It's like alcohol, for example. I mean, we have free access to alcohol, but we're not sitting here smashed off our faces. And I think,
but
speak
you
for
have
yourself,
drinking
silly.
In schools.
Yeah, but what obviously comes with that is obviously a big education program.
Yes.
So the money you get from taxing it, the money you get from the sale of it, goes into education prevention programs as well as clinics for treating, you know, addicts who will inevitably be around. And the bottom line is, let's make it a health issue rather than, you know, a social or criminal issue.
Well, that's exactly what Denver's done as well. They I mean, they released in July their 6 month, you know, 6 months since we
so this is the first
weed.
6 months of,
exactly yeah. And they reported revenue of $20 million and expected by the end of 2014 to have revenue of, I think they at the optimistic level estimated about $100 million. Now, that's just the interesting thing is that that $100 million, hypothetically speaking, it's not going to go into the treasury. It actually gets fed right back into drug addiction rehabilitation programs and the entire regulatory structure, which I think is quite a responsible and a very interesting way to go about it, particularly considering the governor was against it to begin with.
You really see funding coming from there being ring fenced here in South Africa. I don't see it.
Well, I mean, look, we can't make it, you know, can't build things or plan for things assuming that it's going to, you know, cock out at the administrative level. We've got to, you know, try.
It doesn't
and
say
the
we
right
shouldn't
plan.
Try.
We shouldn't try.
The other interesting thing that I read as well about Denver was that they had reported a drop in crime in the first 6 months, which was, you know, overwhelmingly, I think, positive, and we'll probably see a lot more states, I think, follow suit and take, you know, take the cue from Denver. Interesting on that, when I wrote a piece about promoting, obviously, the legalization or decriminalization of drugs, but that marijuana, if it was traded on the Chicago Board of Trade, which is a big sort of commodities exchange in America, if it was traded alongside all the other commodities like wheat and those agricultural commodities, it would have been the second biggest traded commodity on the Chicago Board of Trade. That's the estimated value of marijuana in America. It would be that big. I mean, and imagine
Good
all
grief.
The yeah, imagine all the Good tax grief. Revenue, and then also the counter side to that argument, or the, you know, the other sort of piece that of that puzzle is the fact that something like a third of all incarcerated people in America are in on drug related offenses. Which would make a huge impact in terms of the number, and America has the, I think, the highest number of people in prison per capita. I think it has the same number or just more than China in terms of total numbers. But the population is a fraction, and that would be a massive, you know, release of state funds and resources were those people.
Yeah, I mean,
not,
if you're not arresting
and
putting someone on trial for carrying a bankie of weed. That immediately eliminates a large population of American sort of people arrested on drug charges.
And the massive social dynamic that changes along with that
exactly.
as well. Okay, so coming back closer to home and news at home, Ranjini, we saw the ANC provincial government conference this weekend. some interesting things that came out of that?
Yeah, you know, the ANC in Gauteng is always fashioned it themselves as the game changers. You saw before the ANC's Mangaung conference in 2012 is that they were kind of rocking the boat in the ANC, and they were moving from the position that things can't keep going the way it has. And you know, one of the things that they were angling for in 2012 was leadership change. And they were proposing that Halima Motlanthe take over from Jacob Zuma at the ANC conference there.
Impossibly one of the worst campaigns ever run for any leadership position
the
in the history.
The problem is that they had
positions.
A candidate who really didn't want to run and didn't want to be there and, you know, just was not interested. And so that was their
I'm
big
here
problem.
For the champagne and caviar.
Well, even if it was that, at least there would have been some kind of campaign, you know, behind it if it was just for the champagne and the caviar. But there was just this reluctance.
Like, please leave me alone. Yeah. I want to go home kind of approach, you know. But the thing is that campaign, the fact that it failed, had messed up the ANC a lot here in Gauteng. And you saw the spillover manifested in various ways. It was... The performance at the, in the 2014 elections, the ANC slid by 11 percentage points here, which is the biggest
fall. And
then
just at Mangaung as well, we saw the effect of the Gauteng sort of push for support for Halema. We saw a lot of those big figureheads from Gauteng being sidelined.
Being cleaned out from the National Executive Committee. I mean, somebody as powerful as Paul Mashatile was not elected on an 80-member NEC, and you found like relative nobodies in the ANC coming up instead. So they got severely punished. And they've been in the dog box ever since. And there are other things that kind of made it difficult for them as well. Like, you remember the memorial service of former President Nelson Mandela. There was booing of the president from the stadium, and the ANC in Gauteng got blamed for it. They were basically accused of mobilizing quietly, you know, to embarrass the president. So they've had a lot of baggage to bear. You know, after the poor performance in the local, I mean, in the 2014 elections, there was actually a move from Luthuli House to try and suspend them altogether. But the thing is, what worked in their favor is that the ANC dropped support in 8 provinces. If they tried to make a move against Gauteng, they would have had to, you know, take action against the other guys as well. So they survived that. But what you found is that they launched kind of a ground cover campaign to recover. And they came back fighting. They're basically, you know, able to reject all the Luthuli House appointees in Gauteng, and made a clean sweep of the leadership here. So they're back in force now.
Mm-hmm. So with that, Paul Mashatile was
re-elected and the
chairperson.
They were kind of digging in their heels, even though they performed badly in after the elections, because they resisted attempts from Luthuli House to impose a premier of their choice. Yeah, so they kind of dug in the heels and made sure that David Makhura was appointed. So now you've got this kind of 1-2 formation between Paul Mashatile and David Makhura. And so one of the first things Makhura did as premier was appoint the ETOLS panel. And this came as a shock to everyone, because the matter has been, you know, it's run its course, and everyone thought, okay, there's no option. The only thing you can do is not pay and see what happens. And let the crisis roll out at that stage as to how can you take action against so many people for not paying. So it was supposed to be dealt with there. You know, there was kind of an acceptance that at a kind of policy level, you couldn't really do anything about it. But here, David Makhura comes at the position of premier, and he rocks the boat and says, I'm appointing a panel to see what's the economic impact on this province.
And we've seen a lot of differences of opinion as to what this panel will be able to do, what's within its mandate, what its powers are, and we're seeing that split, that rift between the local provincial government and the national government, and the differing opinions, and the guys at the local level saying, well, hey, you guys are screwing it up for us for the next upcoming local elections, and we have to bear the brunt of those decisions. But you know, in order to protect ourselves, we need to try and fix this mess you've got us in.
The truth of the matter is that the provincial government has no powers to do anything with ETOLS. It's a national competence. They don't even have the powers to suggest alternate means, or, you know, to collect revenue by alternate, is completely a national competence. But the fact that he's gone ahead and done this showed that they're going to try some move. Nobody was quite sure what it is. So what happened on Friday is that Paul Mashatile, in his opening address, he then reveals that actually Devon Makura went and consulted the president before appointing the panel. So you get to thinking, but the president,
if he knew about it,
yes, exactly. Like, what is going on here?
Is it sanctioned?
Is the
president green light this, or does he?
Well, you know, what is the understanding between Makura and Zuma on this thing? Makura won't say. I tried to ask them at the press conference. He just laughed and said, "No, I can't tell you what I discussed with the president." But if you remember, the president made that weird comment that, you know, we have to have the e-tolls, we have to finance the roads. This is not some road in Malawi. He was quite definite on it. Gwede Mantashe definitely said the matter is closed, e-tolls are here, get over it. So now there's something else going on here. Not quite sure what's going on, but then the ANC, so Paul Mashatile then makes this revelation in his opening address. He says, let's support this panel. It's not working out with the e-tolls. Clearly, from the submissions being made to the panel, there's a lot of unhappiness. It's having an impact on this province, but it's having an impact on the ANC as well.
The popularity of the ANC, especially with the upcoming election.
And, you know, there's other things that, you know, that I think national government doesn't consider. People are trying to avoid the national roads, so they're using the inner roads. It's causing damage, it's causing congestion, it's causing frustration.
And they're not collecting the revenue from the main roads.
Yes. So the ones who are driving on the highway don't care.
So we're ending up with a bigger deficit and a bigger cost to bear than we would have originally.
So, you know, there are all kinds of complications. So these guys are tapping into the sentiment here in the province and saying, look, it's not working out. So the matter goes to the conference floor. They come back with a draft resolution on Sunday that says we must support the work of this panel and blah, blah. What happens? Conference says, no, you can't say it like that. Let's make this quite clear. We don't want it. Mm. We want a fuel levy or something else. Mm. We don't want it. Say it specifically. So, the media was given copies of this draft resolution, and I'm reading the text and I'm listening to what the new provincial secretary is reading. I'm thinking, this is a different text altogether because the conference actually, you know, defied the action, you know, what the provincial leadership proposed should be the wording of this thing. The delegates went one further and said, let's reject it. We do not support e-tolling.
Despite having no authority, right?
Yes, they have
no authority.
Make a statement on this. Firstly, this now puts the provincial ANC on a direct collision course with the national ANC. Secondly, if you put out a message like that from the ruling party in the province, backed from the top, from the premier and the provincial chairman, why should you and I pay? If they don't support it, why should we go and volunteer to hand over our money to Sandral? That's the big problem that national government, Sandral, the president, and everybody else has, is that once this message went out, it disrupts the whole thing. So they can't go and, you know, like have roadblocks or whatever and, you know, try and still market this when there is such a strong message coming out from the ruling party in this province.
If the local government is willing to go to such lengths, you know, to distance themselves and to outright reject it, does it show how worried they are for the upcoming local elections?
I think it's more than that. I think they're saying that, listen, national government, you don't know what the hell you're doing. You're completely out of touch with this province. You don't get it. I think that this debate is signaling other stuff as well. People in this province, and Mashatile was hinting at it, the middle class has grown significantly here. They are completely pissed off by Nkandla. They people who grew up in the ANC, have family ties to the ANC, who have the ANC in their blood, are rejecting the ANC because of what the national leadership is doing. So I think they're using this e-tolls thing to make a point that we can still be part of the ANC, but do things differently and signal that we're rejecting what national is doing. So in a way, it's a kind of a proxy thing, but how far they'll push it remains to be seen, because if they use it, I think they're going to make a bid again to kind of interfere with the succession of the succession battle within the ANC. Mm. I think the ANC in Gauteng is going to try and make some point and try and get in people who they think should be in the leadership. Mm. Obviously, they'll have to come up against KwaZulu-Natal, which is...
Who are those people?
KwaZulu-Natal.
No, I mean, from the ANC Gauteng, you know, who are the people that they would want to put forward in support?
Well, they're saying that their presidential candidate at the moment is Cyril Ramaphosa, but it's not only about the presidential candidate. It's about the entire top leadership, six leadership. Structure. It's about the NEC, the people who make all the big decisions. Mm. So, you know, the funny thing is that Cyril Ramaphosa was the candidate of KwaZulu-Natal in Mangaung, but now they've turned on him. They, you know, thinking of somebody else because they feel that they can't trust him. Mm. And they also
mostly following Marikana and...
No. I think KwaZulu-Natal has different considerations. I think that, you know, they have like this big political and business network that they feel will be exposed if Ramaphosa is president, and, you know, like the kind of financial benefits
or
that are
be left out.
Yes,
that,
you know,
yeah, okay.
So he will disrupt that. Mm. So I think Gauteng is trying to make several points using this ETOL thing. Is that we're not going to take it lying down. We're going to take you on. We don't care that we don't have the power, but we're going to do something. Mm. So this ETOL panel finishes its work at the end of November. What you're going to have is sometime before then, the ANC is going to make a submission to government. Now, this is also completely unprecedented. Normally, the ANC makes policy, government implements. Mm. Now you have government has this thing that's been implemented and the ANC saying, we're coming to you to say we don't want it. Stop it. You know, so it's, I don't know how
the provincial level.
At the provincial level. So you don't know. So the thing is that what Makura would then do with the recommendations of this panel, because he can either fight it at government or the ANC can fight it at ANC level. Mm. What also that the ANC has made a point this weekend is that user pay as a form of revenue generation for road maintenance and construction is not ANC policy. Never was, never has been. That's the big problem with ETOLs, is where did it come from? Who introduced it? Because everything that's supposed to happen in this country is supposed to come out from ANC policy. Mm. It's not. Mm. So that is why they still feel that they have a chance to have it scrapped, because it's not policy.
Mm. And reading between the lines that it's not policy, you know, lends one to think that there might be sort of some sinister motives behind it. Well, I don't know, maybe for me at least.
Well, I mean, it goes back to the point that Auta has been making, is that how this thing evolved, because it came in kind of, you know, just kind of got introduced. I think John Flismus makes it the point best, where he says, you know, people saw these big things being constructed on the freeway. Nobody stopped and said, hey, Sipo, what are you doing? You know, and then suddenly, you know, you had all this, like, suddenly carte blanche was running and think, oh, you're going to have to pay for these roads. And, you know, that's how it came about. Yeah. That's how, public realization developed.
So the lack of actual philosophical justification for this, you know, like you say, Stilly, it opens it up for all sorts of scrutiny immediately without even having to break down the, you know, where did this come from? How is it justified under ANC policy?
I thought it was really funny that so many ANC people around the country were saying, hey, really? Yeah, of course. It was an ANC policy. How did it come about?
Doesn't it? I mean, I love the quote, the Oliver Tambo quote in your piece, which is just basically, you know, personifies what's going on between, you know, the split between the local and the national ANC.
Yes, yeah. I mean, Paul Mashatila, I think he was very deliberate in saying, you know, quoting where Tambo says, nobody can destroy the ANC will destroy itself. And he was signaling the fact that, you know, the ANC keeps going to the cliff, you know, and hanging over and, you know, it's not reading the public mood. It doesn't realize how much the image and brand of the ANC is being destroyed by, you know,
scandal after scandal after scandal.
And you know, it's kind of short-termism, because the ANC sees like taking on Julius Malema in parliament over the president. They think that has to do with, you know, the preservation of the ANC. ANC when it's not. It's got nothing to do with the ANC's policies and programs and histories and traditions. It's not. It's about the protection of the president. And so people, you know, don't see that, you know, the actions that they take, the statements they make, the decisions that they carry out, you know, is and the impact that it is happening on that it is having on brand ANC.
But can I ask a sort of open-ended question there? I mean, do you think the ANC will ever have this last straw on the camel's back moment? I'm being too much of a white liberal here, but we always get the impression that Marikana, that's it. Xenophobic violence, this is it. Or Nkandla, there's always this crucial climatical moment that's going to be the downfall of the ANC, and it never materializes.
Do you think 2.0?
Yeah, I mean, well, we'll talk about that next year, I think, when we get to that. But do you think there'll be this?
The thing is that the ANC is 102 years old, and you know there's so much emotional ties to the ANC because it's a party of liberation, because of the history, the number of legends that win. But you can't. The people battled so much in this election, where as angry as they were and disappointed and frustrated as they were with the ANC, and you think when you look at that ANC flag and you look at, you know, you think about what it represents, and it's very difficult to make a cross elsewhere. Mm. And that's the thing. But to answer your question, is that two things are happening. One is that the profile of the country is changing. The memory of apartheid is receding. Mm-hmm. So people are less emotionally tied to the ANC.
The goodwill of liberation is fading.
Yes. Mm. And secondly, eroding, you have this thing where the ANC is doing what Mashatile is saying. It's destroying itself. Mm. It's destroying its own brand, and people can no longer in good conscience support the ANC. So I think you these multiple crises will build to a point. Mm. You know, I who would have thought a year ago that Julius Malema and the EFF would be what it is? It is what it is because of the anger at the ANC. Mm. 1.1 million people went, yes. And there's no alternative, you know, and the ANC is not correcting itself.
So I think to validate what you've just said, I attended the Institute for Race Relations, had a presentation after the election results were released. And the theme from their analysis into the numbers the biggest theme was that there were two elections going on. There was a rural election and there was an urban election. Mm. And if you split those two aside and you look at the drop in the votes at the rural and the sort of urban level, you'll see a big trend starting to form. And that is that in the urban areas, is that there was a massive drop of 10%, basically, in votes for the ANC. Mm. And as you rightly say, the ANC Gauteng government realizes that, sees that, knows what it's up against.
11% is huge.
Knows what it's up against. The rate of urbanization is going to continue happening in South Africa. People are going to continue moving to the cities. And as that happens, as that middle class grows, people are not going to take, you know, the supply of basic services as good enough anymore. Whereas, you know, if you maybe stuck in the rural area, getting water, electricity, and a house for the first time, that's enough to secure a vote for a generation, for example. But as the middle class grows and urbanization grows, people are going to say, no, that's not good enough anymore. We can't have things like Nkandla and Marikana and arms deal and, Travelgate and everything else that's going on.
Yeah, look, the thing about this junk that you're talking about also is that the EFF didn't really campaign in rural areas because it didn't have the time. It was a new party. It didn't have the time and resources, so they didn't really make a big play for rural areas. But now they do have time, and that is why there is some kind of fear about what the EFF can do in the local government elections. But yes, in terms of the urban vote, people have access to information first and foremost. So they know, via radio from sitting
it's
on
not
the
only
train
SABC, yes. They've got access to Daily Maverick,
yes.
And Guardian.
Exactly. And even on the trains, you know, you can read the Daily Sun on the way to work. Even there, you'll be able to see, you know, that the issues are being raised on every media platform. And then also that the breakdown of services is becoming more visible in urban areas. Okay, so there's the issue of the lack of housing and things like that. But also, you've had these water disruptions. Mm-hmm. You've had the billing crises, you know, and add ETOLs to that mix where people are struggling, you know, just to get by. And then they suddenly have to pay for this thing, which they, like Jacob Zuma and Kandler, didn't ask for. So, you know, you have this like toxic
and should have
mix.
Been paid by something else.
Yes.
Like the fuel levies.
Yes. And so you have this toxic mix on a number of things that are making people extremely disgruntled with the ANC government. And the ANC is not paying significant attention to that. So, for example, on the billing crisis in Joburg, it becomes an individual's responsibility to sort it out, to find a way, you know, to deal with it. With the water crisis, you know, the new water and sanitation minister says, oh, it was a glitch because of cable theft. You know, where you have thousands of people impacted, not having water for weeks, you know, and you can't go and say that it means that you're not reading the public mood. Mm. You just don't get it.
Mm. And also how, if, you know, those kinds of problems were there to happen in the rural areas, A, we probably wouldn't even know about it because the media aren't covering it. But B, the disruption, you know, sorry to say, it wouldn't be as massive for people in those areas versus people in the urban areas.
And you see, the ANC has a kind of a one-size-fits-all way of dealing with all these things. You know, it's, we're dealing with it, we'll get back to you, you know, that kind of thing. And they do it with in township areas. Then they go and deploy the police. There's a big street fight, and then people get tired and they go home. And so they just think that they can deal with it. They don't realize. I think that is why the ANC in Gauteng is saying, listen, it can't be business as usual. Something needs to change here.
Well, it certainly makes for interesting times. Not that there are uninteresting times in the South African political landscape ever, for maybe like 5 minutes at a time. before we wrap up for today, what's on the horizon, Ranjini? What's up for the rest of this week?
At the moment, the Powers and Privileges Committee in Parliament is sitting to consider the disciplinary charges against the EFF MPs. I was watching it just before I came here, and it's amazing how Julius Malema is completely controlling Parliament these days.
He walked out now.
He just walked out. He was
shock, horror.
Yeah.
you know, the thing is, if you remember, this stems back from the president's question time, where he demanded from President Jacob Zuma, when will you pay back the money? And that caused the disruption and the riot police be rushing into parliament and all of that. So they're now facing a series of charges. But, you know, Malema was able to yank their chains on every single thing. How they put the read the charges, you know, whether they get to read every single charge to every single EFF MP, or they read it together, you know, he had them by the short and curlies the entire morning. It was hysterical to watch, and you sit there and you look at these ANC MPs looking at each other, not sure what to say next and how to deal with them.
They did look utterly confused.
Yeah,
in the
they
morning.
Were completely bamboozled. Mm. They kept saying, "Can we have time out? Can we have 5 minutes to discuss it?" Because they really didn't know. And then he came with this ass kicking representations. He read for about half an hour, well prepared document, making the argument as to why the ANC cannot be impartial judges on this matter, because they were sitting across the house, they were heckling the EFF, they were part of calling the police in, they basically saying that they've contaminated the process already. How can they sit now and judge them in a disciplinary case? And again, you get the ANC like looking at them flat footed, saying, "Oh, yeah, maybe you're right, but we're not quite sure what to do. Can we please go and phone Letuli out and take instructions?" So eventually Julius says, "I've said what I said. You decide what we want to do. We're not going to be participating in this process. Let's go." And just like that, they got up, walked out. Yeah, so it'll be interesting to see now for the rest of the afternoon what the ANC does, how they deal with this matter. But then on the other hand, parallel to this, you've got the Nkandla matter still plodding on.
The ad hoc committee,
which has also been walked out of.
Yeah.
So you've got, again, the ANC sitting all by its lonesome trying to prepare a report that says, "Oh no, President Zuma is the innocent victim of this." You know, this fire pool and everything else was imposed on him.
The Public Protector's Office should pay towards Nkandla. This is our recommendation.
Yeah, so that's still going on for the rest of the week. But yeah, as you say, in politics, it's never a dull moment.
Well, certainly not in this country. John, what are you looking at this week? I mean, outside of the the ISIS and Ebola stories that'll come up during the middle of the night.
All these wonderful happy places you go to.
Well, I certainly want to look a little bit more into the again, always defense with me, I'm afraid, but looking at the submarines, I believe the one that has been in dry dock for quite a while now and has been the subject of a lot of jokes, I guess, against the SA Navy, is now undergoing sea trials again this week.
How
which
many
is
submarines
quite impressive.
Do we have in our fleet?
I believe we have, well, we have two operational
at
any
operational
point.
Ones?
Yeah.
Okay.
I believe the frigates are busy undergoing refit after their piracy patrols and all that. So it seems like a pretty good time for the Navy, considering there's virtually no money in the SNDF at the moment. So that's quite interesting to see going through this week to see how that pans out.
I don't know if you heard the heard the point. Heard the time the defense minister was answering questions in parliament and revealed that one of the submarines had been damaged because it drove into a wall.
Well, it's the thing is, we have to remember this happens to any navy. It
but
is a submarine,
wall?
After all. There's no windows or anything like that. You get your dock walls and things like that in Simontown. I'm not sure which wall specifically they crashed into, but these things are bloody difficult to steer anyway.
Yeah, you can't really parallel layer, park it. Yeah.
Exactly, it's quite difficult to sort of reverse into this. And the parking is quite tight at Simontown these days, so it's quite tricky. But yeah, I mean, these things happen in other navies all the time. The only difficulty is we have a very limited number. So when one goes down, it's quite a big thing, obviously. And I mean, I think understandably so. Yeah.
And then there's obviously the big, the other murder trial that's happening. Just a quote from our WhatsApp group. I won't name this person.
We're both flipping to our phones now.
Yeah.
To see.
quote, if guns and violence and celebrity and white fear were themes in the Oscar trial, this one is going to be about butt plugs. So on that bombshell, this is goodbye from the Daily Maverick show. I've been your host, Alicia Alamas. I've been joined by the beautiful Ranjini Munsami and John Stupart. Guys, thank you very much for joining us, and we'll look forward to hosting you again next week.